Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In Haiti today, the shock is starting to wear off and the scale of the disaster is starting to sink in. Tens of thousands of people, perhaps hundreds of thousands, are said to have died. And the international community is trying, meanwhile, to help the living. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, for 158 years providing policyholders with solutions to help meet their financial goals at massmutual.com. And by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday today, the 13th of January. Glad to have you with us. President Obama said this morning the United States is going to offer, quote, swift and coordinated aid to the people of Haiti. Assistance is coming in from all over the world to a place that is ill-equipped to receive it. Brian Atwood ran the Agency for International Development during the Clinton administration. He's got experience on the ground in Haiti. Mr. Atwood, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
It must be a tricky thing getting this level of international aid into a place where the infrastructure was already terrible, frankly.
Yes, it is going to be extraordinarily difficult, and I suspect that they'll have to be using a lot of helicopters and other things to get into some of these remote areas. This has affected probably 3 million out of the 9 million people of Haiti. I can't tell you how devastating this is to a very, very poor country whose infrastructure was very bad in the first place, which is why the devastation is always worse in a country like that.
I read this morning that the Haitian economy is basically 80% foreign aid. Is that your understanding?
The GDP of Haiti would be about 80% foreign aid, but most of the Haitian economy is not on record. In other words, it's an informal economy, a lot of bartering that goes on and the like. But there's a huge amount of aid, and in the last few years, that aid has been beginning to pay off. The government has been more stable, and the aid has been used a lot more effectively than in the past, and this is going to really create a major setback.
This is a tricky question, but is there, do you think, an opportunity here once the rescue and recovery is done that the rebuilding of Haiti might actually work out for the better, that it might wind up with better infrastructure and better situations for the Haitian people?
That is the hope, but the first task is going to be to get beyond the chaos created by this earthquake. And that chaos could mean a lot of people using violent means to survive. It will mean a country that really doesn't function as a country. It probably will have to be functioning more as a protectorate of the international community for at least a year or two.
It does sort of sound like you're saying that there's a limit, though, to what international aid can do.
There is a limit during the relief period. Of course, there's a great deal of attention paid. As soon as this is no longer on the front page, it's possible that people will turn their back. And I hope that doesn't happen in this case, because, as you suggest, there is a real opportunity to rebuild Haiti and the Haitian society.
What do you think it might take for that to happen, for that rebuilding in a positive way to happen?
Well, I think there's already an inclination on the part of the Obama administration to focus on Haiti. They've been sending people down. Now the issue becomes much more urgent, and I think if they can carry through and beyond the crisis, there is an opportunity here for Haiti.
Brian Atwood, he's the dean of the Humphrey Institute of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. He was for many years in the Clinton administration, the director of USAID. Mr. Atwood, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
1,500 miles north of Port-au-Prince today, traders on Wall Street found some reasons to buy. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Marketplace quote of the day this Wednesday comes to us from Phil Angelides. He's the chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission that started its public hearings today.
If we ignore history, we're doomed to bail it out again.
A little bit funny, but a little bit not so amusing, really. Congress set up the commission in the hopes that it might help untangle the mess that led us to the financial crisis. The guests of honor on opening day were the heads of four big Wall Street banks, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Chase, and Morgan Stanley. There were some mea culpas in their opening statements. This, for example, from Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase.
Let me be clear. As I've said before, no institution, including our own, should be too big to fail. We need a regulatory system that provides for even the largest financial firms to be allowed to fail in a way that does not put taxpayers or the broader economy at risk. Shareholders, management, and unsecured creditors should bear the full cost of failure.
There were some accusations and some righteous indignation, as in this exchange between Chairman Phil Angelides and Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein.
I'm just going to be blunt with you. It sounds to me a little bit like selling a car with faulty brakes and then buying an insurance policy on the buyer of those cars. It doesn't seem to me that that's a practice that inspires confidence in the markets.
Every
I'm not talking about your own positions.
Every
I'm talking about betting against
of an asset here is an institution, okay. Probably professional-only investors dedicated, in most cases, to this business.
Representing pension funds who have the life savings of police officers,
these
teachers.
Are the
Otherwise, it was mostly a mix of theater and vague solutions. Here's John Mack, the CEO of Morgan Stanley.
I think our regulators and the industry have to focus on complexity. Instruments today can be so complex that even though, let's assume I am a salesperson at Morgan Stanley and you run a pension fund or insurance company, you and I understand what you are buying.
One did get the impression, though, after a day of testimony, that the bankers do know something went horribly wrong.
Anyone who says, I wouldn't change a thing, I think is crazy. Knowing now what happened, whatever we did, whatever the standards of the time were, it didn't work out well.
No, it really didn't, did it? It takes a certain amount of chutzpah to walk away from the biggest consumer market on the planet. But that is where Google appears to be today. Last night, the company posted an interesting announcement on its blog that in the face of cyber attacks aimed at some of its email account holders, the company is rethinking whether it really wants to be doing business in China. David Drummond is Google's chief legal officer. His is the name at the bottom of that blog post from last night. Mr. Drummond, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Kai.
These cyber attacks that you wrote about last night, you don't actually say it, but I gather you either know or suspect that they were done by the Chinese government.
Well, we don't know that. What we can say is that, you know, it came from China, very organized and targeted, you know, toward dissidents, you know, definitely politically motivated. And, you know, that was enough to really cause us to rethink our approach.
When you say rethink your approach, what you really mean is the possibility of Google not doing business in China eventually.
Well, that's I suppose that's a possibility. But what we've done is said that thrown this back to the Chinese government to tell them, you know, we're no longer interested in censoring our search results. But if we can find a way for us to operate there without having to do that, we would love to, and indeed that's our preferred option. But we are realistic about what the response we might get back.
You and other search companies that operate in China have been roundly criticized for censoring your search results. Make the case for me. Why do you do that?
We made the decision that the prospect of us being there and being a part of the forces for openness, you know, that by being there we could help improve access to information for the Chinese people. We would censor less than the domestic search engines do. If the situation changed and we felt that it wasn't opening up, we wouldn't hesitate to rethink our position, and that's what we've done.
You said you've thrown it back to the Chinese government, this issue of censoring search. Have you heard anything from them in the last 24 hours?
Well, we expect to have some conversations very, very soon.
Google is not the biggest search engine in China, which kind of raises this question. If you guys go away, is China going to miss you?
Well, we actually have seen quite an outpouring today of support from Chinese internet users, many of them actually showing up at our office and laying flowers down in the front of our office.
Let me ask you the broader contextual question. As China increases its role on the global economic stage, is this just something that companies doing business there are going to have to get used to, the fact that they're learning how to use their muscle and their might?
Well, I think so. You know, I think that it's important for companies with values to stand up for them and decide when enough is enough. And the thing that I think that's also important is that Western governments, the U.S. government, needs to get more involved to put pressure on China to open up and to be part of the global community. You know, China has to allow more of that to happen.
David Drummond, he's the chief legal officer at Google. He wrote the blog post last night on the Google blog announcing their troubles, you might say, with the Chinese government. Mr. Drummond, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
The financial crisis inquiry hearings that we were talking about a couple of minutes ago are going to go on till the end of the year. The final report is not due until December. But you can already guess what some of the common themes are going to be. Risky behavior, for one. Problem is that we all want to get the economy back to where it was a couple of years ago without doing all the not-so-smart things that we did to get the economy where it was a couple of years ago, like easy lending in the housing industry and all those subprime mortgages. From Washington, Brent Neely has more now on banking behavior.
At this morning's hearings, J.P. Morgan Chase's Jamie Dimon said when it comes to mortgages, his bank was going old school.
We have substantially enhanced our mortgage underwriting standards, essentially returning to traditional 80% loan-to-value ratios and requiring borrowers to document their income.
Banks are going back to 20% down payments and borrowers with steady jobs. Chris Mayer, a real estate economist at Columbia Business School, says that makes sense.
What Jamie Dimon is saying is if we've learned from this experience, it's that we should not be making loans to people with no stake in their house.
Meanwhile, the government is also looking at lending standards. The Federal Housing Administration, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, now guarantee nearly 9 in 10 U.S. mortgages. Yesterday, the FHA said it's investigating 15 mortgage lenders with very high default rates. Mayer isn't surprised.
Because what the FHA is doing is really what subprime lenders did. They're little to no money down, people with very, very dinged credit scores.
But if we want to get back to the go-go days of economic growth, some economists say we're in a tough spot without taking risks. Harvard economist Nick Ritsina says he understands why mortgage standards are tightening.
But it clearly will restrict the number of home buyers. It will restrict demand for housing, and it will certainly have a dampen any recovery in home prices.
And the overall economy. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
House and Senate leaders trooped down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House again today. There was yet another epic meeting on the health care overhaul to work out yet another difference between the House and Senate bills. Today's wrinkle was generic drugs, getting them to market sooner and saving billions of dollars. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genza reports.
When the patent on a brand-name drug like Lipitor expires, competitors can start producing generic versions that are a lot cheaper. But there are often disagreements over when generics can be introduced. Rather than go to court, the branded drug makers pay the generic folks to delay their drugs. The Federal Trade Commission reported today that these so-called pay-for-delay settlements cost consumers $3.5 billion a year. John Leibowitz is the chair of the FTC.
When companies make these payoffs, they get a longer period of exclusivity. When companies receive these payoffs, they sit it out. And that's not good for consumers.
The House health care bill would outlaw pay-for-delay deals. Congresswoman Mary Jo Kilroy, an Ohio Democrat, says the lack of generics hurts her constituents.
I've heard from people who have heart medications and have had a very impossible time for paying for their drugs to get half of their prescriptions.
But the pay-for-delay deals do have their defenders.
But I'm not sure that it's an entirely good idea to outlaw them.
Eric Gordon is an economist at the University of Michigan. He says some pay-for-delay deals get generics out sooner because they avert lengthy court battles.
Rather than a blanket ban, the test ought to be whether or not it's a legitimate settlement or an abuse.
An army of drug industry lobbyists is making the drug maker's case on Capitol Hill. Leibowitz says there are more than 1,300 registered lobbyists for drug companies. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up, stimulus contracts for convicts.
But then they go to sad math about, oh, the poor guy and nothing to do all day long now. We're trying to keep busy. That's true. But why pick on people who are law-abiding citizens, though? Why take their income?
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials picked up 0.5% today. 53 points ended at 10,680. The NASDAQ put on 1.1%, 25 points, 2307 at the bell. The S&P 500 advanced 0.8%, 9 points, ended the day at 1145. Bank CEOs may have been on the griddle, but most financial stocks weren't really feeling any heat at all. JPMorgan Chase piled on 1.75%. Bank of America deposited 1.5%. Goldman Sachs pocketed 0.75%. Morgan Stanley up 0.4%. News that Google might leave China sent investors for the exit. Shares were down more than 0.5% today, but it was a buying moment for the search giant's competitors. Baidu, that's China's version of Google, soared nearly 14%. Yahoo stepped up 1.33%. Microsoft picked up nearly 1% today. Bond prices fell. When that happens, yields rise. In today's case, on the 10-year T-note, to 3.79%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, working to strengthen America by empowering more young people to achieve educational success beyond high school. What does setting interest rates have in common with driving a car? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases data on retail sales for the month of December. The Commerce Department also reports on business inventories for November. And on January 14, 1952, the morning news and talk program Today premiered on television. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Everybody is seeing green on Sesame Street today. Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment has done a deal with Sesame Workshop. That's the nonprofit group that produces the show. The plan is for a series of video games featuring Kermit and Elmo and the rest of the gang. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports it's all about showing young gamers a new way to get to Sesame Street.
Sesame Workshop and Warner Brothers are hoping a new series of games for young children will tell them how to get to a big chunk of the $21 billion video game industry. Ben Beharin is a consumer technology analyst and has a four-year-old. He says Sesame Street is in a unique position to take video games younger.
Part of this being driven by the parents, they're looking for trusted brands that they're familiar with or that they think may resonate with their children, at which point they'll feel comfortable making a decision, you know, integrating that brand into the household.
Sesame Street airs in over 140 countries and has been a household mainstay for 40 years. Ann Beharin says many new parents grew up gaming, so they won't hesitate to buy video consoles for their young children.
Cookie starts with C. Let's think of other things that start with C.
Like Capture. Tech industry analyst Rob Enderle says capturing consumers when they're young could really pay off for Warner Brothers.
Done properly, this could bring people into the Warner family of products and carry them up much like Disney does. So just because you outgrow Sesame Street may not mean that you lose track of Warner Brothers.
So today's Big Bird fan will be tomorrow's Bugs Bunny, Scooby-Doo, and Lord of the Rings fan.
Yeah, I wish I'd thought of that.
Warner Brothers and Sesame Workshop plan to start releasing games for the Xbox 360 and Sony's PlayStation 3 later this year. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith, brought to you by the letters MP.
For all the excitement about the Detroit Auto Show yesterday, today was a bit of a letdown. All the opening day buzz is gone, and the problems of the American car industry are still with us. Today, the head of one of Detroit's biggest parts suppliers said he is expecting only moderate sales this year and that a new Cash for Clunkers program would be a real good thing. Commentator Robert Reich says there is no easy fix.
Automakers are trying to be upbeat. 2009 was a disaster, but December sales were up, and the auto execs are hopeful this means strong momentum into 2010. Never underestimate the power of wishful thinking in Detroit. Auto executives need to face two realities. First, there's no longer an American auto industry. The big three are selling cars all over the world. Foreign automakers are selling them here. Parts are coming from everywhere. That may be good news, considering all the Chinese and Indians who want cars. Last year, Chinese consumers bought more cars than Americans did. 3 years ago, the tables were reversed. Americans bought twice as many as the Chinese. But the second reality is there's a giant glut of automaking capacity. Right now, the world auto industry can produce almost 90 million cars and light trucks a year. 90 million. You know how many were actually sold worldwide last year? 60 million. The worldwide auto industry, in other words, has a third more capacity than it needs to satisfy worldwide demand. Now, sure, demand is growing in China and India. But China and India are busily building new plants to produce even more cars. So even as global sales grow, the glut is growing too. All this means the world auto industry, including GM, Ford, and Chrysler, will have to rationalize, consolidate, reduce capacity. Bailing out GM and Chrysler, bailing out GM's finance division, giving cash for clunkers, hoping the American auto industry will bounce back, throwing another big auto show in Detroit. All this is irrelevant to the real challenge. And that challenge is getting new, good-paying jobs for all the auto and auto parts workers who will continue to be laid off, even when the U.S. economy is fully recovered, and helping Detroit and other auto communities create new industries that move people from place to place at minimum cost with minimum carbon. This is what the Detroit Auto Show ought to be about, not more cars.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Send us your advice for the auto industry or just your comments on the program. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The federal stimulus package that Congress passed back in February was really about one thing, jobs, and lots of them. The government is spending almost $800 billion to put Americans back to work. Today, the White House said the stimulus bill has saved or created as many as 2 million jobs, a figure, it should be said, that is not universally accepted. But Karen Wise explains that who is getting those jobs can sometimes be surprising.
Barges that float down the Mississippi River carry more than half of the nation's grain exports to the port of New Orleans.
You could call it a waterborne interstate highway if you would.
Alan Dooley is the spokesman for the Army Corps of Engineers in St. Louis. The Army Corps operates a series of locks and dams that allow barges to maneuver down the river. And for the boats to do that safely, the area needs giant signs.
These signs vary from the size that you might see along a hiking trail to the other extreme signs that are 30 feet long that are mounted on the locks and dams.
Some of the river signs needed to be replaced, so the Army Corps dipped into its pot of federal stimulus funds. It bought $143,000 worth of signs from a company called Unicor. But Unicor's not your typical sign company. It's run by the Federal Bureau of Prisons and uses inmates to do its work. Unicor pays inmates an average of 93 cents an hour to make everything from office furniture to solar panels to signs. All told, Unicor has almost $900,000 in stimulus contracts so far.
We think it's terrible. There's too many people need a job, not the prisoners.
Norman Hawkins runs a sign company in Berkeley, California. He says forget the prisons. His company could use the stimulus work.
But then they go to sad math about, oh, the poor guy and nothing to do all day long now. We're trying to keep busy. That's true. But why pick on people who are law-abiding citizens, though? Why take their income?
Hawkins is 89, and his father started the company over 60 years ago. Now, Hawkins Traffic Supply employs around 20 people in a shop right off Interstate 80.
Matter of fact, when they opened this highway on the other side, we made the first signs for them.
Now, half of their business is from government contracts, but not from the Army Corps.
it might be something that people might look at and say, well, why would you employ people in a prison?
The Army Corps' Alan Dooley.
But the stimulus package does not exempt us from existing federal regulations.
And believe it or not, those regulations said the Army Corps had to give the signed contracts to Unicorps. Now, those regulations are generally seen as a good thing. They're supposed to minimize fraud and waste. But in this case, the use of prison labor diverges from the goals of stimulating job creation.
Certainly is a head-scratcher, I'll put it that way.
Steve Ellis is a vice president at Taxpayers for Common Sense, a nonpartisan government watchdog.
The idea that we are sending stimulus dollars to prison industries really flies in the face of the unemployment lines that we're seeing across the country.
Ellis realizes that Unicorp's $900,000 worth of contracts is just a fraction of the overall stimulus program. But he says it's a good example of competing priorities in the stimulus. He says the program was supposed to create jobs, to create them quickly, and to improve the country's infrastructure. And it was supposed to do all of this while following the usual contracting guidelines to minimize waste. Ellis says we just can't have it all. The Army Corps' Dooley points out that at least some local employers will benefit from the SIGN project along the Mississippi.
People are going to work to manufacture the material and to deliver the signs and install the signs.
Don't forget, inmates can't do all the work. The part that has to happen outside prison walls. I'm Karen Wise for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final thought today about the financial utility of social media after the Haiti earthquake. If you want to donate or offer help or find somebody on the ground there, Facebook and Twitter are the places to be today. Red Cross and Help Haiti are the top phrases on Twitter this afternoon. Haitian singer Wyclef Jean has set up a donation mechanism via text message. And this outtake from my interview with former AID director Brian Atwood up at the top of the show, to pass along to you. Don't send clothes, he told me. Don't send food. Send money. That's what aid groups can really, truly use. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 53 points. That's about 0.5%. The NASDAQ rose 25 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 added 9 points. That is 0.8%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time on this broadcast, right when General Motors started thinking big, its business hit the skids.
Now, I'm not going to say that that goal was the entire downfall of GM, but obviously strict adherence to goals can cause these kind of problems.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.